Chapter 31 Revolutionary Science. In February 2002, as most of the paranormal activity at the Gorman Ranch slowed to a mere trickle, NIDS scientists received a calling card of sorts, a little reminder that weird things could still happen. A perfect circle appeared overnight in a shallow, ice-covered pond not far from the main house. The circle was carved into the ice, approximately 1/4 inch deep and just under 6 feet in diameter. It was mystifying how this could have been done, let alone why. The ice was so thin that any sort of weight on top would have broken it. There were no footprints in the mud that surrounded the pond, except hoof prints from the cattle that grazed nearby. The NIDS team reacted as scientists should. Close examination of the circle indicated that the counterclockwise motion of a sharp object had delicately carved a circular impression in the ice and had caused ice shavings to accumulate at the edges of the grooves. The investigators collected the ice shavings from the circle and some from a control spot elsewhere on the ice and placed them into sterile test tubes for later study. All shavings from the ice circle, as well as controls, were subjected to elemental analysis by X-ray fluorescence to look for any residues, possibly metallic, from whatever sharp instrument had so delicately carved out the ice circle. The tests yielded nothing of note. The scientists also took readings for magnetic fields, electrical fields, and radiation in a 100-yard radius around the ice circle. They checked the cattle and the surrounding environment for any unusual markings or tracks, but found none. Ice circles have periodically been found in other parts of the world. In Russia, much larger circles have been seen and photographed on frozen lakes. Witnesses claim that the deep impressions were caused by UFO-like craft that were seen touching down. As far as we know, though, there are few precedents for the small, fragile carving that appeared on the ice pond on the ranch, although a short time later, a family from Connecticut sent NIDS a photograph of a perfectly drawn 20-foot diameter circle in the ice outside their home. However, the ice circle on the ranch was accomplished. It required a deft touch to make the carving without breaking ice so thin. And for what purpose? Was it meant as a teasing reminder that while NIDS might be close to giving up on the ranch for the lack of significant activity, the intelligence behind it all was still around, still unseen, and still a mystery? 4 centuries ago, the predecessors of modern scientists were struggling to move beyond the magic and magical thinking that were inherent in alchemy. Since the Age of Enlightenment, there has been an ever-increasing gap between the scientific method and mainstream science's attitude toward anomalies. Today's science establishment conveniently forgets that Sir Isaac Newton, one of the icons of modern scientific thought, spent far more of his time studying and writing about alchemy than he did about physics. When faced with the mystery of the ice circle, the NIDS scientists reacted as they were trained and in full compliance with the rules of modern science. They took samples, searched for clues, and analyzed what physical evidence was available. Yet, it is likely their colleagues would excoriate them for giving even a moment's thought to something so weird and seemingly insignificant. Scientists today generally shun anomalies. The weirder the anomaly, the greater the professional stigma against studying it. Nevertheless, the study of anomalies is central to the discovery process in science. Studying anomalies can open important doorways through which science can enter while traveling toward revolutionary discoveries. There is a distinction between normal science and revolutionary science. In his controversial book, The Structure of Scientific Revolutions, Thomas Kuhn argued that the majority of scientists engage in normal science. They stand on the shoulders of giants from the previous generations and rarely make giant leaps forward. Kuhn writes, "Normal science does not aim at novelties of fact or theory, and when successful, finds none. New and unsuspected phenomena are, however, repeatedly uncovered by scientific research, and radical new theories have again and again been invented by scientists. Discovery commences with awareness of anomaly, i.e., with the recognition that nature has somehow violated the paradigm-induced expectations that govern normal science." Of course, Kuhn was referring to experimental anomalies, not necessarily the physical anomalies found on the Gorman Ranch, but his message still applies. The lessons that Kuhn drew for the experimental anomalies that pop up during the practice of normal science are equally well-suited to science's first hesitant attempts to study the physical anomalies that abound in the paranormal. The latter anomalies are simply more extreme versions of what Kuhn had in mind. According to Kuhn, there are a small number of revolutionary scientists. These often lonely individuals or groups are engaged in creating paradigm shifts or in the creation of new scientific disciplines. They are the solitary people on the road less traveled who often have to endure the hostility or marginalization by colleagues. But, according to Kuhn, the scientists engaged in revolutionary science are the ones who make a difference. They make possible the giant leaps forward. They are the visionaries. As might be expected, Kuhn's book, when it was first published, led to a firestorm of criticism because it insulted the hard work of the majority of scientists who are engaged in normal science. And, of course, most scientists prefer to think of themselves as the harbingers of new paradigms, but the majority of scientists are, according to Kuhn, mere technicians, elaborating upon or tinkering with the ideas of those who have gone before them. Kuhn called this process of normal science puzzle-solving. Any investigation of paranormal events would certainly be categorized as revolutionary science. After all, such phenomena do not have any precedent according to scientific studies and superficially appear to break the laws of science. When a scientist begins approaching these extreme anomalies, there are huge risks, not only to his or her career, but also to the work itself, since it necessitates the adaptation of scientific methods to a topic where predictions, theory, and previous experimental evidence are either absent, scanty, or incomplete. It is in this strange land that the scientist must learn to navigate while at the same time try to persuade his or her colleagues that such a study has inherent value and is not a complete waste of time and effort. In approaching something that has no precedent, great care must be exercised against gullibility while at the same time maintaining an open mind. For many scientists, walking this fine line is impossible. Yet we argue that the study of extreme anomalies can follow the same rules that Kuhn laid out for experimental anomalies. The study of extreme anomalies has great value in accelerating the discovery process. The scientific method is built on precedence, repeatability of experiments, and having enough data to make testable predictions. When a phenomenon under study refuses to obey these rather narrow strictures, what happens? What happens when a possibly intelligent phenomenon refuses to be predictable? Does a scientist walk away? Should the NIDS team have simply pretended that the ice circle never appeared or that the calf dismemberment was a figment of their imagination? Is it possible to utilize the scientific method to study an intelligent, extreme anomaly? Herein lies an enormous challenge that is made doubly difficult if the majority of one's scientific colleagues do not even accept the reality of the phenomenon under study. Publication of data in scientific journals becomes difficult. Presentation of data at scientific conferences becomes impossible except for those marginalized societies that are devoted to studying these phenomena. And to put it bluntly, these societies are poorly attended, have almost no funding, and exist at the boundaries of the scientific community. In other words, they have no impact or influence on science or on how it is conducted. Obtaining grants to study or research these phenomena is impossible without publications in mainstream science journals, which in turn becomes impossible if there are insufficient resources to gather the data. These factors that accumulate in the sociology of science make the task of initiating the study of anomalies extremely difficult. Political perceptions and peer pressure contribute to the reticence of scientists to tackle unpopular topics. In March 2005, the Associated Press reported the results of a study conducted by researchers at three major universities. The study found that many, if not most, scientists and researchers shun controversy when choosing research topics. They avoid topics that might be frowned upon by colleagues, concerned that their professional reputations might suffer. More than half of the scientists interviewed said they felt constrained by informal and unspoken rules about what should and should not be studied. In addition, of course, the federal government, which controls the bulk of all science research dollars, frowns upon controversial research projects. Federal funds for research into paranormal topics are all but non-existent. Small wonder, then, that so many modern scientists choose to stick with safe research projects and goals. The advent of NIDS, with comparatively large resources due to the philanthropic generosity of real estate and aerospace entrepreneur Robert Bigelow, aimed to at least remove the lack of resources from this part of the equation. However, even with substantial resources, scientists at NIDS still had to face the daunting task of studying something for which very few previous hard data existed. In fact, there was little or no hard data even to suggest the existence of these phenomena. Whatever reliable information existed was scattered across multiple, generally low-quality science journals. The challenge faced by the NIDS scientists was to come up with some methodologies that might address these meager precedents. In doing so, it was very necessary to walk that intangible line between gullibility and overdone skepticism that might result in missing the boat altogether. In approaching the study of extreme anomalies, it has become possible to recognize that there is essentially no difference between the gullible believers and the extreme skeptics. Although superficially both camps seem poles apart and frequently attack each other, in reality, both groups are the same in many respects. Both have abandoned the cautious attitude of the scientist, and both have stopped thinking critically. Both are, in fact, equally useless, as they tend to impede and even sabotage the study of extreme anomalies. Both the true believer and the knee-jerk skeptic have the effect of muddying the water and of obscuring the fragile data in a deluge of noise. Both extreme points of view contribute to the reluctance of mainstream scientists to plunge into the study of anything that is even remotely tainted by the paranormal label. The penalty for violating the unwritten prohibition against investigating forbidden topics can be harsh, even for well-established professionals. John Mack, a brilliant Harvard psychiatrist and Pulitzer Prize winner, was nearly run out of academia when his interest in alleged alien abductions became common knowledge. Mack was not only subjected to a 15-month-long inquisition by university lawyers and skeptical colleagues that threatened to strip him of his tenure and his job, he also became the butt of jokes and the object of ridicule among contemporaries, who simply could not fathom how someone of his stature could suggest that reality may not be what it seems. He was accused of being a UFO nut and true believer, a scientist who had abandoned the sacred protocols of his profession. It's often said that I'm a believer and have sort of lost my objectivity. I really object to that, Mack told the TV interviewer, because this is not about believing anything. I didn't believe anything when I started. I don't really believe anything now. I'm come to where I've come to clinically. In other words, I worked with people over hundreds and hundreds of hours and have done as careful a job as I could to listen, to sift out, to consider alternative explanations, and none have come forward. Mack survived his inquisition, with considerable assistance from Harvard Law professor Alan Dershowitz, and he continued his research until his untimely demise. Instead of pulling back from controversy, he plunged forward into more controversial territory. He came to believe that there was some sort of connection among all manner of so-called paranormal activity, including telepathy, remote viewing, psychokinesis, near-death experiences, spirit manifestations, crop circles, shamanic journeys, UFOs, the power of prayer, and much more. Mack came to advocate the ultimate blasphemy, a new concept of reality. Taken together, these phenomena tell us many things about ourselves and the universe that challenge the dominant materialist paradigm, he wrote. They reveal that our understanding of reality is extremely limited. The cosmos is more mysterious than we have imagined. There are other intelligences all about, some of which seem to be able to reach us. Consciousness itself may be the primary creative force in the universe, and our knowledge of the physical properties of the physical world is far from complete. The emerging picture is a cosmos that is an interconnected, harmonic web vibrating with creativity and intelligence, in which separateness is an illusion. Mack came to believe that although the scientific method is valuable, even essential, for studying those phenomena that make up the material world as we understand it, the rigid structure of modern science simply can't cut the mustard when it comes to evaluating other realities or those phenomena that seem to straddle the known world and unseen realms. In contrast, the NIDS team resolutely stuck to the tenets of the scientific method. NIDS conducted an excursion into what Jacques Vallée elegantly described as forbidden science. But the scientific method remained intact even though the experimental terrain became surreal. The ranch in Utah offered the possibility of a laboratory of unusual happenings, none of which were easily classifiable. It is easy to understand why science has always stayed away from studying these subjects. How does one begin? Why should these subjects be studied? We argue that one answer is that these anomalies do indeed offer a window into studying potentially new models of physical reality, as well as offering new directions in physics and psychology. And studying anomalies offers scientists the potential to build a bridge into new areas and disciplines where science can't operate. No phenomenon really breaks the laws of science. A new phenomenon may create a disturbance in the status quo. It may open doors toward establishing new theories. And in doing so, it may force scientists who are willing to venture into uncharted territory to break truly new ground. For about 400 years, there has been a divide between the physical world and the metaphysical world. The former is the province of scientists, and the latter is the domain of theologians and mystics. Tradition has it that never the twain shall meet. But is this really the future for humanity? Science can continue only so long to ignore phenomena that literally invade people's lives and that have fundamental effects on the worldview of millions of people around the world. The gap between the direct life experience of many people and the reality that is recognized by science is leading many to adopt an anti-science attitude. In the past 30 years, a growing segment of society has begun to view science and scientists with distrust and suspicion. Scientists are increasingly associated with the development of unbridled technology and a lack of ethics or morals. The discovery and deployment of the atomic bomb, of genetically engineered organisms, of biological weaponry, are all laid at the feet of scientists and science. The development of these technologies, some of which the public regards as having spiraled out of control, is seen as a reflection of hubris and arrogance in science. And, at the same time, science ridicules and trivializes a lot of profound but anomalous experiences. People cannot help but wonder at the truth capacity of science if it completely denies the reality of a large number of their own experiences. Public opinion polls show that science and scientists are increasingly out of step with the people's worldview. Though the benefits of conducting revolutionary science are obvious, it has frequently been argued, often persuasively, that the events on the Utah ranch did not necessarily lend themselves to classical hypothesis-driven scientific methodologies. A more appropriate methodology, given the phenomena we faced, might have been one utilized by the intelligence agencies, which, in turn, is based on scientific principles. This intelligence approach to the problem was explained a few decades ago by Jacques Vallée in his classic work, Messengers of Deception. In that book, Vallée introduces a Major Murphy, who enunciates some of the basic principles and approaches that the NIDS staff agreed should be followed more closely in the Utah Ranch investigations. It is worth quoting the initial conversation between Vallée and Major Murphy at length. Then he posed a question that, obvious as it seems, had not really occurred to me. What makes you think that UFOs are a scientific problem? I replied with something to the effect that a problem was only scientific in the way it was approached, but he would have none of that, and he began lecturing me. First, he said, science had certain rules. For example, it has to assume that the phenomenon it is observing is natural in origin rather than artificial and possibly biased. Now, the UFO phenomenon could be controlled by alien beings. If it is, added the major, then the study of it doesn't belong in science, it belongs in intelligence, meaning counter-espionage. And that, he pointed out, was his domain. Now, in the field of counter-espionage, the rules are completely different. He drew a simple diagram in my notebook. You are a scientist. In science, there is no concept of the price of information. Suppose I gave you 95% of the data concerning a phenomenon. You're happy because you know 95% of the phenomenon. Not so in intelligence. If I get 95% of the data, I know this is the cheap part of the information. I still need the other 5%, but I will have to pay a much higher price to get it. You see, Hitler had 95% of the information about the landing in Normandy,
but he had the wrong 95%.
Are you saying that the UFO data we use to compile statistics and to find patterns with computers are useless? I asked. Might we be spinning our magnetic tapes endlessly, discovering spurious laws?
It all depends on how the team on the other side thinks. If they know what they're doing, there will be so many cutouts between you and them that you won't have the slightest chance of tracing your way to the truth. Not by following up sightings and throwing them into a computer. They will keep feeding you the information they want you to process. What is the only source of data about the UFO phenomenon? It is the UFOs themselves.
Some things were beginning to make a lot of sense. If you're right, what can I do? It seems that research on the phenomenon is hopeless, then. I might as well dump my computer into a river.
Not necessarily, but you should try a different approach. First, you should work entirely outside of the organized UFO groups. They are infiltrated by the same official agencies they are trying to influence, and they propagate any rumor anyone wants to have circulated. In intelligence circles, people like that are historical necessities. We call them useful idiots. When you've worked long enough for Uncle Sam, you know he's involved in a lot of strange things. The data these groups get are biased at the source, but they play a useful role. Second, you should look for the irrational, the bizarre, the elements that do not fit. Have you ever felt that you were getting close to something that didn't seem to fit any rational pattern? It gave you a strong impression that it was significant? The events that occurred on the Utah ranch certainly gave us the impression that they were significant. So Major Murphy was perhaps correct. This research project was beyond a simple scientific problem that was amenable to standard hypothesis-driven science. It involved hunting a very wily quarry. And NIDS constantly had to accept the possibility that any information acquired in this hunt was only the information that the intelligence, assuming that we were in fact dealing with an intelligence, wanted us to have. The phenomenon became much more elusive when NIDS took over the property in August 1996. Tom Gorman believed that the phenomenon took extraordinary measures to become much more opaque and hidden almost immediately after NIDS assumed control. Our attempt to target a wily and deliberately evasive research subject is perhaps unprecedented in scientific research, but is the norm in the cat-and-mouse games of espionage and counter-espionage. For example, hunting the skinwalker transcended what wildlife scientists normally do to hunt or track wild animals because the target of the NIDS hunt proved over and over its capacity to keep a couple of steps ahead of us. According to Major Murphy, the art of intelligence gathering and the techniques of counter-espionage are much more appropriate when dealing with active deception. A second main ingredient in Major Murphy's advice suggests that NIDS should follow a more proactive and less reactive stance toward the phenomenon. One example of our proactive strategy had its genesis in a nugget of information Tom Gorman acquired during his protracted interactions with the phenomenon. He found that whenever he made changes to the topography on the ranch, for example, by removing a tree line or by digging a new irrigation ditch, there would be fresh appearances of mysterious flying objects. So NIDS tried several times to provoke the phenomenon by digging. In several instances, neighbors reported sightings of a low-flying orange object that disturbed the animals within 48 hours after we had dug large trenches in symmetrical rows. But in no case did the surveillance cameras that constantly recorded the airspace above and on the ranch pick up the flying object. Nor were NIDS personnel able to provide visual corroboration of the object, even though the object was said to be heading toward the Gorman property. The NIDS team decided to take this proactive approach a step farther by attempting to initiate a direct dialogue with the phenomenon. Ideas were kicked around about possible ways to communicate with the entity, or how to encourage it to communicate with us. In one experiment, we placed see-through Perspex boxes containing pictorial and alphabetic patterns at various points around the property. The premise, as slim as it might seem, was that the unknown intelligence might try to communicate directly with us by manipulating the letters or pictures in the boxes. Unfortunately, nothing happened. In retrospect, the experiment might seem far-fetched and overly hopeful, but we were navigating uncharted waters, looking for out-of-the-box ideas. Experimentation, after all, is supposed to be a fundamental component of the scientific method. The investigation of the phenomena at the Gorman Ranch was an ambitious, if unconventional, example of what science is supposed to do. Explore the unknown. Ask questions about the unexplained. Poke around and see what happens. Honest inquiry into unanswered questions is, or should be, a textbook definition of what science does. But finding answers is not always part of that definition, even when engaged in normal science. Making sense of the big picture is a tall order. Though we can eliminate a few of the hypotheses, hoax, group hallucination, and tectonic strain theory, there is simply insufficient data to be able to select a likely solution to the events among the remaining possibilities. Part of the reason for this is the incredible variety of paranormal experiences we encountered at the Skinwalker Ranch. That was one of the most unsettling aspects of our investigation. It's as if some cosmic puppet master had written a laundry list of every spooky phenomenon of modern times and then unleashed them all in a single location, resulting in a supernatural smorgasbord that no one could possibly believe, even less understand. The events were random and unpredictable and never happened more than once in the same place or in the same way. If there is an intended message or lesson in all of this, what could it possibly be? Needless to say, everyone who played a part in the investigation has logged many a sleepless night while pondering this central question without arriving at a satisfactory answer. Today, the types of events recorded in this audiobook are still occurring around the United States and in other parts of the world. They remain unexplained. And science continues to look the other way.